Welcome to The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain, here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. During the next hour, you'll hear articles from the November 17th edition of the magazine. On the cover this week, in a highly cartoonishly sketched snow-capped mountains, a cartoonishly drawn skier has crashed headfirst into deep snow, nearly to his waist. The backside of his yellow ski pants are spotted with snow that appears to roughly represent a map of the Earth. And his red, bent skis appear as red arrows pointing downward, as in a chart. And the headline reads, "How Markets Could Topple the Economy." The cover article this week is Artificial Intelligence: How Markets Could Topple the Economy. And the four other leader articles I'll be reading are Trade and Exchange Rates, the Hidden Risks in Taiwan's Boom, Do Adjust Your Sets, How Exasperating, Indispensable BBC Must Change, Taking on the Gangs, Mexico's Surprising Record on Murder, and The Horn of Africa, How to Avoid Africa's Next War. And we'll follow that with as many international articles as we have time permitting. Now, on to our cover article. Artificial Intelligence Test: How Markets Could Topple the Global Economy. If the AI bubble bursts, an unusual recession could follow. If America's stock market crashes, it will be one of the most predicted financial implosions in history. Everyone from bank bosses to the IMF has warned about the stratospheric valuations of America's tech companies. Central bankers are bracing for financial trouble. Investors who made their names betting against subprime mortgage bonds in 2007 to 9 have resurfaced for another big short. At any sign of a wobble, such as a recent slight weekly fall in the NASDAQ index of tech stocks, speculation mounts that the market is on the precipice. And no wonder. The cyclically adjusted price-earnings ratio of the S&P 500 index of stocks, propelled by the magnificent seven tech giants, has reached levels last seen during the dot-com boom. Investors are betting that the vast spending on artificial intelligence, AI, will pay off. Yet the numbers are daunting. For companies to achieve a 10% return on the AI capex projected by 2030, they will collectively need $650 billion of annual AI revenues, equivalent to over $400 per year per every iPhone user, reckons JP Morgan Chase, a bank. History shows such lofty expectations are often disappointed, at first by new technologies, even if they go on to change the world. Yet, although the market crash would surprise almost nobody, few have thought about its consequences. And that's partly because the chances of a big fall in stock markets bringing about a broad financial crisis are, for now, slim. Unlike in the late 2000s, when widespread leverage and complex financial engineering helped cause a debt-fueled bubble in subprime housing, today's AI euphoria has been mostly equity-financed. What's more, the real economy has shown in recent years that it can weather shocks, from Europe's energy crisis to American tariffs, remarkably well. Recessions are increasingly rare events. Still, it would be a mistake to think that the effect of big stock market losses would stop at the wallets of investors. The longer the boom goes on, the more opaque its financing becomes. And even without financial Armageddon, a dramatic stock market fall might at last topple a hitherto resilient world economy into a downturn. The root of the vulnerability is the American consumer. Stocks account for 21% of the country's household wealth, about a quarter as much again as at the height of the dot-com boom. Assets related to AI are responsible for nearly half of the increase in Americans' wealth over the past year. As households have become wealthier, they've grown comfortable saving less than they did before the COVID-19 pandemic, albeit not as little as during the subprime boom. Crash would put those trends into reverse. We calculate that a fall in stocks comparable to the dot-com bust would reduce American household net worth by 8%. That could cause a big retrenchment in consumer spending. By one rule of thumb, the pullback would amount to 1.6% of GDP, enough to push America, where the labor market is already suffering, into a recession. The effect on the consumer would dwarf what is likely from any drying up of AI investment, much of which goes on chips imported from Taiwan. The shock and weaker American demand would spill over to low-growth Europe and deflationary China, compounding the blow to exporters from Donald Trump's tariffs. And because foreigners have $18 trillion worth of exposure to American stocks, there would be a mini wealth effect globally. The good news is that a global recession with its roots in the equity market need not be deep, just as the downturn that followed the dot-com crash was shallow and avoided by many big economies. Importantly, the Federal Reserve has enough room to lower interest rates to boost demand, and some countries would respond with fiscal stimulus. Yet, a downturn would expose vulnerabilities in today's economic and geopolitical landscape by further weakening America's hegemony, undermining government budgets, and worsening protectionist instincts. Without the AI boom, the American economy would be left looking as it did in the spring, threatened by tariffs, beleaguered institutions, and increasingly fractious politics. As we publish this, America's longest ever government shutdown was only just coming to an end. And in a recession, America would usually be a haven. But in these circumstances, and with America taking the worst growth downgrade, a rush to the dollar, which is down by 8% this year, would not be assured. Although a weaker dollar would be a blessing for the rest of the world, for which a pricier greenback tightens financial conditions, it would strengthen the idea that American exceptionalism is not what it was. The risk to the dollar would be especially great given that 2026 could bring far greater political influence over the Federal Reserve, as our annual supplement, The World Ahead 2026, explains. A recession would also put indebted governments everywhere to a stern fiscal test. Central banks would cut interest rates, easing the cost of servicing the rich world's enormous debt pile, which is worth 110% of its GDP. But deficits would widen too, as welfare spending rose and tax receipts fell. In the most vulnerable economies, fiscal fears might cause long-term bond yields to stay put, or even rise as central banks cut short-term rates, a dynamic that has occasionally been on display over the past 2 years. It's hard to imagine markets affording France or Britain, say, much space for stimulus. The final consequence would be for trade. Americans spending less would almost certainly reduce the trade deficit, which would please Mr. Trump. With markets in a bad way, the White House would also be less belligerent on trade. But the other global trade flashpoint, China's surplus in manufactured goods, would worsen. Already, European and Asian producers must compete with a glut of Chinese goods, which is growing as China exports less to America. A slowdown in America would cause that glut to swell further, sharpening the protectionist backlash. The world may be predicting an American stock market crash. That does not mean it's prepared for the consequences. That was Artificial Intelligence Test: How Markets Could Topple the Global Economy. The next Leader article is Trade and Exchange Rates: The Hidden Risks in Taiwan's Boom. A weak currency policy is punishing consumers and storing up financial risk. Taiwan is envied for its exporting prowess. It is home to all of the world's cutting-edge chip making. But much less appreciated is its towering current account surplus, the result not just of a trade boom, but of a long undervalued currency. This aided Taiwan's export-led rise, but it also has long outlived its purpose. While manufacturers have been coddled, ordinary Taiwanese consumers have been deprived of the fruits of growth, and financial risks are building up. It is time for Taiwan to loosen its grip on its currency. Taiwan's vast surpluses have been years in the making. For decades, its central bank, known as the CBC, has kept the currency undervalued, giving manufacturing exporters a competitive boost. According to the GDP-adjusted Big Mac Index, our measure of how far exchange rates depart from their underlying values, the Taiwan dollar is 55% undervalued against the American dollar, the most in the world. As a consequence, in this century, Taiwan has run the world's biggest current account surplus as a share of output, once Unterpots and Petzerpots are excluded. And lately, thanks to the artificial intelligence boom, Taiwan's imbalances have gone into overdrive. In October, its goods trade surplus hit a record high of 31% of GDP in annualized terms, a quadrupling since the pandemic. According to the latest data for this year, Taiwan's current account surplus has reached 16% of GDP. By comparison, China, the archetypical surplus economy, is running a current account surplus of just 3%. The problem with all this is that the cheap currency has become a costly and dangerous anachronism. For a start, it no longer delivers the benefits it once did. Taiwan is no longer an industrializing economy. Its annual GDP per person now exceeds that of Japan. Its stock of foreign reserves at $600 billion is large enough to cushion the impact of a Chinese blockade or a financial crisis. And the best of Taiwan's chip and computer makers, which are responsible for 3/4 of the total exports and nearly half of nominal GDP, can shrug off a stronger currency. A 20% appreciation in the Taiwan dollar would knock perhaps 8 percentage points off the operating margins of TSMC, the world's leading chipmaker, still leaving them plumper than Alphabet's or Apple's. At the same time, the costs and distortions of having an undervalued currency are mounting. First, it's a tax on consumers. In an economy that depends on imports for food, fuel, and goods, the cheap currency has shifted purchasing power from ordinary households to exporters. The result has been that even by export economy standards, Taiwan saves too much and consumes too little. Since 1998, private consumption as a share of output has tumbled by 20 percentage points. A policy that was meant to help Taiwan get rich is now depriving ordinary Taiwanese. Another distortion is that the cheap currency is inflating property prices. Printing currency to buy foreign exchange has flooded Taiwan's financial system with liquidity and pushed down interest rates. That combination lies behind a quadrupling of house prices since 1998. And the weak currency policy has seeded deep risk in the heart of Taiwan's financial system. A third distortion. To recycle the proceeds of its surpluses, Taiwan has lent on its life insurance industry, which has poured nearly $11 trillion of household savings largely into American treasuries. But that has created a giant currency mismatch because Taiwan dollar liabilities are being funded with American dollar assets. An abrupt move in either currency would wipe out the insurers, threatening a financial crisis. Why, then, has the policy persisted? One reason is that the export lobby, Taiwan's chipmakers, could withstand a stronger currency, but existing policy has propped up a cohort of manufacturers that subsist on thin margins and could be severely hurt by an appreciation. Such firms make up perhaps 70% of manufacturing employment. Another reason is the CBC's unusual power. Printing Taiwan dollars to hoover up foreign currency assets has minted handsome profits, which are remitted to the government and have become a big source of revenue. Central bank transfers make up 6% of total government receipts, compared with a rich world average of 0.4%. This bolsters the CBC's political authority, allowing its powerful governor to cow critics into submission, something the CBC denies. The situation is becoming increasingly precarious. One risk is that further depreciation in the American dollar destabilizes Taiwan's life insurers, which have become too big to fail. A second danger is that American trade surplus hawks take flight again, using tariffs and their security leverage to force Taiwan to revalue. That could happen at any time. And unlike South Korea, Japan, or China, Taiwan has yet to clinch a trade deal with Donald Trump. Fears of such a clash after Liberation Day were enough to spark an abrupt 9% depreciation of the currency against the greenback in May. That's why Taiwan just unpicked its outdated economic model and built a better one. The CBC should gradually loosen its grip on the currency. Inevitably, the transition will be fraught with political and financial risks. Manufacturers kept on life support by Taiwan's export subsidy will have to scale back or shut down. Too rapid an appreciation could blow up the life insurance industry. But those risks can be managed. Taiwan's government, with gross debt of just 23% of GDP, has room to help retain laid-off workers. Insurers will suffer losses, but can manage the transition if they're given time. The CBC also has a crucial advantage. Gently strengthening a currency is easier than doing the opposite, as Javier Milei is discovering in Argentina. The CBC can always print Taiwan dollars to fend off speculators preempting a stronger currency. The key is for the CBC to establish a long-term path for the currency, as Singapore does. China, too, has managed a modest yuan appreciation in recent decades. And in return, ordinary Taiwanese will at last be able to enjoy more of the fruits of their country's extraordinary export miracle. That was Trade and Exchange Rates, the Hidden Risks in Taiwan's Boom. Let's move on to our next leader article. Do adjust your sets. How the exasperating, indispensable BBC must change. Its latest crisis needs to spur reforms to bolster its news division. Most of Donald Trump's broadsides against the news media are ridiculous. But his anger over a BBC documentary about him that aired last year is justified. An episode of Panorama, a venerable current affairs show, spliced together two unrelated remarks by Mr. Trump to create what looked like a call for violence on January 6, 2021. It was an egregious case of what America's president likes to call fake news. The stitch-up of Mr. Trump's follows a string of editorial missteps. In February, a BBC documentary about Gaza neglected to mention that the 13-year-old narrator's father was a Hamas official. In June, it broadcast a live music performance featuring calls for the deaths of Israeli soldiers. The BBC's boss, Tim Davie, was right to quit this week, but that may not be the end of it. Mr. Trump says he will sue for $1 billion. Though he has less leverage over the BBC than he did over American broadcasters, he's previously shaken down. The BBC's critics at home have renewed calls to gut it. Their central accusation is one of bias. The BBC's journalism is far from corrupt, as Mr. Trump claims, and it makes a better stab at political balance than many European public service broadcasters. But there is some truth to the accusation of a cultural slant. Age and region have replaced social class as the main political divides in Britain, making it harder than ever for young, London-based organizations to reflect the country's attitudes. Surveys show that right-wing Britons are less happy with the BBC than centrists and left-wingers. Since everyone has to pay for BBC, that disparity is a problem. Yet much of the criticism is led by people whose preferred solution would be to get rid of the BBC altogether. That would be a terrible mistake. The BBC is one of the world's biggest sources of original reporting. As newspapers wither and television is swallowed by streamers like Netflix that don't do news, a future with a smaller or non-existent BBC News would be one in which less was known about the world. BBC provides what America sorely lacks, a central repository for fact. It also plays an outsized role in debunking fake news with services like Verify, that work that has seldom been more necessary. The BBC has even greater value abroad, where it's a source of soft power for Britain and a standard bearer of liberal values more broadly. The Trump administration has foolishly tried to silence Voice of America and cut aid to foreign news outlets, just as China, Russia, and others pour resources into spreading their authoritarian ideas around the world. On Facebook, the five most followed news pages are run by Chinese outlets, pushing their version of the news in English. The BBC's page is sixth. Cutting back now would be an act of self-harm. That's why the BBC should be reimagined to focus on the vital public service output that the market does not provide. In the streaming age, audiences are spoilt for choice when it comes to entertainment. So it's absurd that Britons are forced to pay for BBC shows such as Strictly Come Dancing. Better to turn its entertainment arm into an opt-in service and bolster its news operation with stable, arm's-length public funding, whether from a license fee or general taxation. A more sharply focused BBC would be better equipped to navigate a media landscape evolving at dizzying speed. The corporation has been slowed down by bureaucratic inertia and a cumbersome governance structure. A shakeup might usefully include replacing its warring top brass with people who are interested in improving the BBC's coverage, rather than merely defending or sabotaging it. A strong BBC is good for Britain and the world. A clumsy one will be a liability. That was Do Adjust Your Sets. How the exasperating, indispensable BBC must change. Next, our fourth leader article, Taking on the Gangs, Mexico's Surprising Record on Murder. Claudia Sheinbaum's security strategy is working. She has a mountain to climb. Donald Trump's war on drug gangs has so far consisted mostly of blowing up small boats off Venezuela and Colombia. At least 76 people have been killed in strikes that are almost certainly illegal. The Pentagon claims that the vessels it destroys are carrying drugs to the United States. The world's largest warship, the USS Gerald R. Ford, has just arrived in the Caribbean to join the fray and to heap pressure on the dictatorial regime of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. Should worry Mexico that its northern neighbor wields deadly force so freely against alleged drug traffickers. For years now, the country has been overrun by some of the most powerful drug gangs on the planet. They, not gangsters from Venezuela and Colombia, are the true source of the fentanyl that claims some 50,000 American lives every year, the drug problem about which Mr. Trump is most exercised. Moreover, Mr. Trump's government cares little for any distinctions between gangsters and the governments which allow them to operate within their territory, whether through collusion or incompetence. The United States labels Mr. Maduro a narco-terrorist and sends its most powerful military assets to his shores. Mexico's politics are riddled with drug money and mobsters, too. Mr. Trump could unleash violence against the real threat on his doorstep at any moment. That would destabilize Mexico's politics and its vital trading relationship with the United States, already assailed by Mr. Trump's tariffs. Claudia Sheinbaum, Mexico's president, understands that allowing extensive drug trafficking operations to continue in her country exposes Mexico to significant peril. He also wants to stop gangs murdering around 30,000 Mexicans each year. A secure Mexico matters for its own people, for North America, integration, and prosperity, and to keep Mr. Trump at bay. Throughout her campaign and presidency, security has been the issue that Ms. Sheinbaum has emphasized most. So, Mexicans will welcome the good news. Since taking office in October of 2024, Ms. Sheinbaum's government claims to have cut murders by 32%. That figure overstates the improvement, but our analysis suggests that the underlying trend is real. Arrests are up, as are seizures of weapons and drugs. The amount of fentanyl seized in the United States border is way down. Although it's hard to say whether that represents a genuine reduction or merely gangsters finding new smuggling methods. Ms. Sheinbaum is the first Mexican leader in years to curb the power of gangs. And yet this is merely a good start on a gargantuan problem that solving of which will run long beyond her term in office. To push the gangs back further and fend off Mr. Trump, Ms. Sheinbaum must spend more on security and criminal justice. Her government spends less than 1% of GDP on them, and its plans for 2026 cuts the security ministry's budget by 18%. That is indefensible when gangsters run much of the country. Government should also be more honest about the situation it faces. It's made genuine progress against gangs and the violence they perpetuate. Trumpeting cherry-picked statistics is unnecessary and damages long-run credibility. Most difficult of all, Ms. Sheinbaum must confront Mexico's rotten politics. She has yet to investigate powerful politicians, many of them in her own party, who are credibly accused of links to criminal groups. Unless the political criminal nexus is broken, any reduction in violence cannot last. Mexico has plenty of other problems: creaking energy infrastructure, flaccid economic growth, and a large fiscal deficit. But without consistent improvements in security, and confidence that such improvements will continue, making Mexico a better place to live and invest will be all but impossible. And if Ms. Sheinbaum cannot convincingly curb Mexico's gangs, Mr. Trump may attempt to do it for her. That was Taking on the Gangs, Mexico's Surprising Record on Murder. You're listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell. If you missed any part of this program or any other of our great broadcasts, you can stream it from our website, sunsounds.org, or from our Sun Sounds mobile app, available for both Apple and Android phones. Now, let's go on to our fifth and final leader article, The Horn of Africa: How to Avoid Africa's Next War. Pressure from America and its allies can prevent a return to fighting. 3 years ago, one of the deadliest conflicts of the 21st century ended when Ethiopia's government struck a peace deal with the Tigray People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, the ruling party of the country's northernmost region. Hundreds of thousands may have died in the brutal war that preceded the deal. Now it's unraveling. Abiy Ahmed, Ethiopia's autocratic leader, is ignoring it and many in the TPLF and Tigray's armed forces sound ready to return to the battlefield. Ominously, skirmishes are breaking out on the region's southern border. Ethiopia's army has responded with drone strikes. On November 7th, the TPLF accused the government of a strategy of extermination. Another war in Tigray would be a catastrophe, not just for Tigrayans and other Ethiopians. It would intensify and expand the sprawling multi-country conflict zone that now covers much of the Horn of Africa, creating what may be the largest area of violence and anarchy in the world. A feature of this conflict is the role of outside powers, including some Gulf states, which exert influence over their proxies. The best chance for de-escalation lies with America and their outside powers, who must push their allies to stop fighting and start talking again. Ethiopia is home to 130 million people and is among Africa's most fissiparous and fragile states. Bloody insurgencies have raged across the multi-ethnic federation since Mr. Abiy took office in 2019. Renewed fighting in Tigray would spill across Ethiopia's borders. It could draw in Eritrea, a Gulag state in the north run by a long-serving dictator, Isaias Afwerki. Mr. Abiy struck a peace deal with Eritrea in 2018, winning a Nobel Peace Prize in the process. But relations have deteriorated. Mr. Abiy wants to grab access to the Red Sea, which Ethiopia lost when Eritrea succeeded in 1993. Many now fear a new war over Eritrea's ports, and perhaps even over Eritrea's independence. It's possible Eritrean troops might fight alongside the TPLF. Meanwhile, Sudan, stretching alongside Ethiopia, Tigray, and Eritrea, is gripped by its own savage civil war. The danger is that all these conflicts merge into a regional war with fighters and flows of arms and refugees mixing. It's not too late to prevent this scenario if powerful outsiders use their clout. Mr. Abiy counts the United Arab Emirates, the UAE, as his most prized patron. Last year, Eritrea signed a security pact with Egypt. This year, it's been trying busily to bolster ties with Saudi Arabia. America has influence both indirectly through its Gulf allies and through its relationships with Mr. Abiy and Mr. Isaias, both of whom want warmer bilateral ties with the superpower. Encouragingly, American diplomats have been pushing for restraint, in contrast to 2020, when America implicitly gave a green light to Ethiopia's war on Tigray. In a visit to Ethiopia in September, Massad Boulos, President Trump's African advisor, discouraged Mr. Abiy from pursuing sea access by force. America has also threatened sanctions on several Tigrayan officials who it fears are warmongering. America, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE must push Ethiopia and Tigray to avoid war and honor the peace agreement of 2022. Mr. Trump has shown a willingness to try to defuse conflicts, brokering a truce in June over Eastern Congo, and last month underwriting a deal between Cambodia and Thailand. Both are imperfect and fragile, but better than nothing. Mr. Trump makes no secret of his desire to follow Mr. Abiy in his footsteps and bag a Nobel Peace Prize. Both men should remember it's easier to stop a war from starting than it is to end one. That was Horn of Africa, How to Avoid Africa's Next War. Let's move on to international news and begin in China with this article. Ugly Cute Contest. China's growing global fan club. Our new poll shows global opinion is swinging its way. China appears increasingly cool, declared Jin Liang, a spokesperson for China's foreign ministry earlier this year. To make his case, he pointed to consumer product sensations and cutting-edge technology. After all, this year, China has celebrated the success of the ugly cute Labubu toy and DeepSeek and experimented with flying cars. Foreign friends, Mr. Jin purred, were breaking through their cognitive cocoons. Soft power victories matter both to China and to its president, Xi Jinping, in the country's bid to be a superpower. And Donald Trump is handing those successes to his Chinese counterpart. His chaotic policymaking means many now see China as a stabilizing presence. In the eyes of the world, China seems to be growing into an awesome rival to America. To test this thesis, The Economist, working with GlobalScan, a consulting firm and polling firm, asked 32,000 people in 32 countries for their views on China and America between July and September. The results are startling. Since we last asked the question a year ago, China has made big gains as the world's preferred leading power. The share of respondents favoring China jumped by 11 percentage points to an average of 33%. Meanwhile, support for America slipped below a global majority of 46%. China wants to be America's peer. Preference for China as the world's leading power has risen in every place sampled by GlobeScan. Perhaps most surprisingly, that includes America, where support for Chinese leadership doubled to a still low 6%. Meanwhile, 2 in every 5 Americans thought that China's influence on the world was mainly positive, up from a quarter during Mr. Trump's first term. Preference for China strongly correlates with age. The younger the respondent, the more likely they are to welcome Chinese leadership. Among 18 to 24-year-olds, America and China are nearly tied for support at 41 and 39% respectively. Among those over 65 years old, America has a commanding 30-point lead. Many youngsters use Chinese products and services, like the video sharing sensation TikTok, or follow social media influencers who have visited China. Earlier this year, state media in China has found offering expense-paid trips to China to such types. When it comes to picking China as the leading power, the latest regional increases were in Latin America and Europe. In Brazil, Canada, Mexico, South Africa, and Spain, preferences for China rose and support for America fell by about 20 percentage points. The largest single increase was in Indonesia, where support for China leapt by 23 percentage points to 62% to make it the second most pro-Chinese country behind Egypt. There were only fractional rises in China's neighbors. Security concerns dominate views of China in Japan and South Korea, where no more than 5% of respondents preferred China. For perhaps the first time, more than half of respondents in Africa and the Middle East opted for China. Many already liked the country anyway, which may be partly thanks to China's Belt and Road Initiative. In the past decade, the scheme has seen tens of billions of dollars invested in those regions. Still, this most recent bump of 9 points takes China over the majority mark, so lends some credibility to China's claims to lead the global south. Overall preference for China is only part of the story. The list of China's supporters also reads as a roll call of America's discontents. Mr. Trump has picked fights with South Africa over false claims of white genocide, and Brazil for prosecuting its former president and MAGA ally, Jair Bolsonaro. America's neighbors, Canada and Mexico, have both been hit with tariffs and threats of invasion. America's star tends to dim under Republican presidents and sparkle under Democrats. But what is new is that the fall in affection for America is so clearly to the benefit of its biggest rival. That was Ugly Cute Contest, China's Growing Global Fan Club. Next, we widen the Asian view with this article, One and Done? A bombing in Delhi raises tensions in the region. But India's restrained response suggests there is little immediate risk of hostilities with Pakistan. In May, as a brief India-Pakistan air war wound down, Narendra Modi, India's prime minister, announced a new counter-terrorism doctrine, automatic retaliation. If there is a terrorist attack on India, he warned, a fitting reply will be given. So when a car exploded outside the Red Fort in Old Delhi on November 10th, killing at least 8 people and injuring 20 others, the region took a sharp breath. But for now, the risk of another war remains low. The blast appears to be linked to a plot that was broken up by India police earlier that day in Faridabad, near Delhi. Police discovered weapons, ammunition, and huge quantities of material for making explosives. 7 men were arrested. Police in Jammu and Kashmir, an Indian territory, said they were part of an interstate and transnational terror module with links to Jaish-e-Mohammed, JEM, a Pakistan-backed military group, and Ansar Ghazwat-e Hind, an Al-Qaeda-linked outfit in Kashmir. The car that exploded in Delhi was traced to Umar Unnavi, a doctor who's reported to have escaped those raids. Some Indian authorities have privately briefed journalists that the plotters were acting at the behest of Pakistan-backed handlers. But Indian leaders have not repeated that charge in public. Notably, in contrast to a massacre in Kashmir in April, which precipitated the May skirmishes, the attackers appear to be Indian citizens rather than Pakistani infiltrators. One Indian expert who asked to remain anonymous, owing to the sensitivity of the topic, says he's dubious about the plotters' alleged links both to Al-Qaeda and JEM, two very different groups. The former has been non-existent for a long time in India, he says, and in any case, JEM sees Al-Qaeda as a competitor rather than a collaborator. The Indian Mujahideen, a domestic outfit that was active in the 2010s, has been dormant, with its supporters ebbing away to more informal networks. Terrorism against major Indian cities has been rare over the past decade. A bombing linked to Islamic State at a cafe in Bangalore last year was the first such attack in years. The last major attack in Delhi was in 2011, when a briefcase bomb killed 15 people. Ajay Sahin, director of the South Asian Terrorism Portal, a website that tracks violence in India, argues that would-be terrorists might find it easier to operate outside Kashmir, where they face intense pressure from law enforcement and intelligence agencies. Mr. Sani dismisses the notion that the Delhi blast could mark the start of another wave of terrorist violence of the sort India faced in the 1990s and early 2000s. At the time, he says, militant groups were strong and the state was weak. Now the situation is reversed. The fact that police were able to unearth and dismantle the Faridabad cell is itself a sign of the state's good handle on the problems, he said. The provenance of the plotters, the fact that their plans were thwarted, and Mr. Modi's decision to press ahead with a scheduled trip to Bhutan all suggest that there's little risk that India chooses to launch airstrikes on Pakistan, as it did after a terrorist attack in 2019, and again more forcefully this summer. Barring new evidence that points to direction from abroad. Nevertheless, relations with Pakistan remain rocky. On November 11th, a suicide bombing in Islamabad, Pakistan's capital, killed at least 12 people. The Pakistani Taliban, a jihadist group, claim responsibility. More than 1,600 Pakistani civilians and soldiers have died in attacks this year, the worst toll in a decade. Pakistani leaders blame the latest attacks on Indian state terrorism. That claim, retorts India, is the product of an obviously delirious Pakistani leadership. That was One and Done. A bombing in Delhi raises tensions in the region. Next, we turn to the Middle East and Africa with this story, The Remnants of War, The Dangers Beneath Gaza's Rubble. The devastated strip may have more unexploded bombs than anywhere in the world. Unexploded ordnance, or UXO, is the long tail of conflict, killing and maiming long after the bombs stop falling. A year ago, the government media office in Gaza, run by Hamas, estimated there were over 7,000 tons in the strip. That would be more per square meter than perhaps anywhere else in the world. For Gaza's militants, this presents an opportunity. For years, they've remade this stuff into new weapons to use against Israel. For Gazans, they are yet another danger. Smaller munitions, grenades, mortar shells, and improvised explosive devices are in or on the rubble. In October, Yaha and Nabila Shorbasi, six-year-old twins, were badly injured after mistaking an explosive for a toy. Greater danger lies further down. Israel dropped thousands of bombs on Gaza, some weighing more than 900 kilograms. That's a ton. Some were fitted with delayed fuses to detonate inside buildings or underground. Concrete cushions the fall of bombs, which means they may not detonate on impact, but rather tunnel underground. Disposing of this ordnance safely is lengthy, expensive, and dangerous work. Britain has pledged £4 million, or $5.25 million U.S. dollars, to the United Nations Mine Action Service, the UNMAS, for demining. 8 years after the nine-month campaign to expel Islamic State from Mosul in Iraq, UNMAS is still clearing UXO. Israel bombed Gaza far more heavily. In Gaza, Israel restricts both the experts and the equipment needed for clearance. Palestinians are not permitted to train in explosives disposal. International specialists are rarely granted entry. Much of the necessary kit appears on Israel's list of banned dual-use items. Deminers are improvising. Old food sacks are filled with sand to use as blast shields. Even with the right tools, Gaza's conditions are testing. In Mosul, residents were evacuated while explosives were cleared. In Gaza, people have nowhere to go. UNMAS prints warnings about UXO on food aid packets, but when they find explosives, they can do little more than mark them. Meanwhile, Hamas continues to repurpose those they find to continue its fight. That was The Remnants of War, The Dangers Beneath Gaza's Rubble. Next, we move on to Europe with this article, Mobsters Online, How Italy's Mafia Uses Social Media to Recruit New Blood. TikTok is struggling to contain it. In Italy's mafia underworld, the traditional professions of extortioner, hitman, and drug runner are being supplanted by a less risky occupation, social media influencer. A new young generation is stepping out of the shadows and into the limelight of TikTok, according to a report by the Fondazione Maga Grecia, or NGO, that promotes the development of Italy's southern Mezzogiorno region. Mobsters are exploiting the social media app to normalize their image, mythologize their culture, and even to launder money, the study said, which analyzed 6,200 TikTok posts found. Having long understood that fear is a blunt instrument, criminal networks are packaging their message in the language of aspirational consumption. One recent criminal investigation found the Amato Pagano clan near Naples used content featuring fast cars, glamorous parties, and ostentatious wealth to recruit new affiliates, who were then trained in extortion. Naples chief prosecutor has warned that mafia outfits recruit young people by showing them wealth and easy money. The designer accessories and alluring backdrops not only help project power and visibility, but also act as a smokescreen for violence, helping to overcome moral reticence, according to the report's editor, Marcelo Revenduta of the University of Salerno. You don't even need to threaten people anymore. You just say, look at my TikTok, says Mr. Revenduta. Some bosses have even used TikTok to control their clan from within jail, researchers reported, using emoticons such as a black flag for mourning, a chain for imprisonment, and an hourglass for revenge. TikTok's algorithm, based on user interaction, soon subjects casual users to a perpetual torrent of violence, loyalty, and ostentation, including wives of prisoners offering advice, photos of victims of clan wars, young heirs flaunting luxury brands, repentant mafiosi offering commentary, and parades of scooters designed to intimidate. The report said, this continual exposure to grief, violence, luxury, and prison has trained audiences to consume criminal imagery as entertainment. In July, TikTok signed an agreement with Italy's Anti-Mafia Parliamentary Commission and has since removed thousands of videos flagged for glorifying violence or gangster life. The company says it now uses algorithms and researchers to remove 99% of unacceptable content ahead of complaints. But the speed and ingenuity of content creation make for a hard time catching up with the latest version of one of Italy's oldest professions. That was Mobsters Online, how Italy's mafia uses social media to recruit new blood. Next, we move north to Britain for this article of Mollusks and Men, a slimy scheme to avoid property tax. From snail farms to sham churches, the British will do anything to dodge taxes. Unlike their French neighbors, Britons tend to be sniffy about eating snails. But there's a new fad involving the delectable gastropods that Brits have a taste for: tax avoidance. The scheme is both slimy and simple. When a commercial property is vacated, a landlord becomes liable for its taxes, known as business rates. To avoid them, on a 5,000-square-foot office in central London, those taxes might be £12,000 or $16,000 a month. Some landlords turn their offices into farms. Boxes of live snails are purchased for £14 each, and the property is claimed to be an agricultural unit, exempt from business rates. Urban snail farms are seen by local authorities and the courts as a sham. One venture in Liverpool had 15 boxes with as few as 2 snails each. Adam Hugg of Westminster City Council says it's hard to stop such behavior because the schemes are run by agents hiding behind shell companies. After a court finds the farm illegitimate, the business simply declares itself insolvent and the tax liability must be written off. A cottage industry of advisors exists to minimize business rates. When a property is vacated, landlords can claim 90 days of empty property relief, EPR, from business rates. A loophole allows landlords then to store empty boxes, or any other item, in their property for a 6-week period of occupation, after which they can claim another 90 days of EPR. By doing this over 12 months, they can reduce their tax liability by 75%. To discourage this box shifting, last year the government extended the eligibility period for EPR from 6 to 13 weeks. In recent years, schemes claiming full business rate relief as places of worship have proliferated. The owners of a science park in rural Kent with a £1 million annual liability says, to the incredulity of the local authorities, that all 60 of the units are now, in effect, houses of God. Landlords have easier ways to reduce their taxes. ASTOP, a social enterprise, matches landlords to legitimate charities that take temporary rent-free occupation of properties when they fall vacant. Charities then claim 80% of business rate relief on the landlord's behalf. The government says it wants to devise a fairer system fit for the 21st century. Schemes to avoid business rates have serious repercussions. The annual £24 billion, or 0.8% of GDP, tax yield from commercial property is lower than in earlier years, as landlords and their tenants take advantage of exemptions, many legitimately. Westminster City Council will rake in £2 billion from business rates this year, but 90% of it is sent to the Treasury, which disperses it around the country. A tax-dodging snail farm in Marylebone can affect social care budgets in Middlesbrough. That was Of Mollusks and Men, a slimy scheme to avoid property taxes. And that's our final article for today. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the November 17th edition of The Economist. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Jim Mitchell, in Sun Sounds of Arizona. It's been my pleasure to read them. Thank you for listening. Tune in next week for another edition of The Economist. And stay tuned for more interesting programming right here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.